Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I'm Felix Contreras. Just a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, the actor James Franco discusses playing Allen Ginsberg in the new movie Howl and his unexpected role on the soap opera General Hospital. NPR film critic Bob Mondello contemplates Clint Eastwood's latest film, Hereafter, a supernatural drama that follows characters affected by death. And Elton John reunites with Leon Russell on the new record, The Union. But first,
talk about arty aspirations. Hard to think of an action movie with three Oscar winners in the cast, but the new movie Red does. Helen Mirren, Morgan Freeman, and Richard Dreyfuss. In spite of all that star power and firepower, film critic Kenneth Turan finds the picture isn't all that explosive.
Seeing Helen Mirren let loose with a machine gun is an ultimate movie experience, like watching the Queen of England lay waste to a crowd of unruly commoners. It's also the only dark corner of Red that satisfies as it should. Red is an acronym for Retired Extremely Dangerous. That's a group of former CIA agents led by Bruce Willis who've been sent out to pasture in favor of younger, presumably deadlier government operatives.
Bad move, Grandpa.
Red's very complex plot starts with Willis having to rescue a woman, played by Mary Louise Parker, he's been flirting with over the telephone. The first time they meet in person, she thinks he's kidnapped her.
Just hoping you'd be a little more understanding of the situation.
I was hoping not to get kidnapped or drugged. I was hoping you'd have hair. Thanks for saving me, I guess.
No problem.
Willis and an increasingly friendly Parker make contact with old comrades in arms like Helen Mirren, who's trying to convince herself she's happy being retired.
I love it here. I love the baking. I love the flower arranging. I do get a bit restless sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I take the odd contract on the side.
The other actors run hot and cold, but Mirren is most at ease in her role, handling her lines with aplomb and firing automatic weapons like she means it. The problem with Red is that it can't stop trying too hard to be hip. Its inescapable air of self-satisfaction is not only unearned, it's downright irritating. Lots of fine actors wander through this mayhem, including Morgan Freeman, John Malkovich, Richard Dreyfuss, Brian Cox, and even Ernest Borgnine. But their combined abilities still can't make a dent in the film's smugness. Red is too violent to be a comedy and not funny enough to counterbalance all the violence. It has its moments of machine gun-toting charm, but there are way too few of them to go around.
The movie is Red. Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
For most of his career as an actor, Clint Eastwood has been pretty predictable. Strong, often heroic, but always with a dark side. As a filmmaker, he's been anything but predictable. Just in the last 10 years, Eastwood has made a somber murder mystery, a female boxing film, and a pair of ambitious World War II pictures. He followed those with a kidnapping drama, a film about racism in Detroit, and another about Nelson Mandela and South African rugby. Well, as different as those movies are, Bob Mondello says that none of them sets you up for Eastwood's latest effort, Hereafter.
The first 7 minutes of Hereafter will knock your ears back. A huge tidal wave, the Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004, slams into a resort where a French journalist is shopping in a street market. The town is reduced to splinters and the journalist drowns, gone, lifeless. And then, long after some folks trying to revive her have given up, she coughs, sees soft-focus visions of blurry figures and bright lights, and miraculously comes back to life. I wish I could say the same thing happens to the sober, heartfelt movie she's in. After that startling disaster flick opening, Hereafter gets hit by a slow-motion tidal wave of afterlife hokum, and you can feel it slipping away, despite director Clint Eastwood's best efforts to keep it on life support. His biggest ally in that struggle is Matt Damon, playing an extremely unwilling psychic who keeps being approached by strangers who want him to do readings, even on the staircase to his apartment.
I don't do readings anymore.
You did one last week, yeah. Mr. Andrews.
I know. Well, he's an associate of my brother's. It was a one-time thing. I don't.
Please, I brought money.
I don't want your
everything
money.
I have.
I don't.
I lost my only job. I just want to talk to her. Please, I want to talk to my baby.
I can't help you. I don't do that.
Please.
Damon's character is supposed to be the real deal. When he holds hands with someone, even for just a second, he can see any dead folks they happen to be grieving for. Understandably, he wears gloves where he can. But sometimes there's just no avoiding holding hands, say with a gal he meets in a cooking class.
We never had this conversation.
Why?
Because if we open the door and go down that road, any chance that we had of having something normal will just be gone. You know, knowing everything about someone, it seems nice, but really, maybe it's actually better to hold stuff back.
He may not want to go there, but there are three plot threads in Hereafter, and the folks in the other two really do. That French journalist who briefly drowned, she writes a book about a conspiracy to hide the afterlife. The surviving half of an adorable pair of identical twins, he goes to fake spiritualists to look for his dead brother. And screenwriter Peter Morgan, who wrote hard-nosed scripts for Frost Nixon and Last King of Scotland, he trips down a rabbit hole into sentimentality. Not that Clint Eastwood's filmmaking isn't as graceful and as unhurried as ever. He's made this meditation on mortality stately and elegant, sort of a babble for the supernatural set. Beautifully shot globetrotting from Asia to California to Europe. Performances that are earnest and low-key. It's as if everyone figured they could keep Hereafter from turning ghost story hokey by making it grounded and attractive and matter-of-fact. And it sort of works. There are no inadvertent giggles here. It just doesn't add up to enough after. I'm Bob Mondello.
The actor James Franco is setting a new standard for what it means to be eclectic in Hollywood. In his latest film, Howl, Franco slips into the character of beatnik poet Allen Ginsberg.
What is the Beat Generation?
There's no Beat Generation. Just a bunch of guys trying to get published.
As Jesse Baker reports, being a movie star is only one of the passions James Franco pursues obsessively.
James Franco has a hard time defining exactly what he does for a living.
I still get paid the most for acting, but the past 4 or 5 years I've been putting a lot more energy into other parts of my life.
Not just a few other parts of his life. He's writing short stories and reinventing poems.
You know, poems usually aren't turned into films, but I've done that a few times now.
He's modeling.
Gucci by Gucci.
He's playing a guy named Franco on the soap opera General Hospital.
So many women, so little time.
He's calling that performance art. Oh yeah, he's also painting and setting up art exhibits on both coasts. And just in time for Oscar season, he's starring in Danny Boyle's next big thing, after Slumdog Millionaire.
So the guidebook says that the route's through here, but I know a better way.
It's called 127 Hours. It's a true story about a hiker who gets trapped by a boulder in Robbers Roost, Utah. Franco's multifaceted artistic endeavors have become a running joke, even for the actor himself.
Could you bring out the bin?
This is his opening monologue from Saturday Night Live last December.
This bin is filled with idea slips that people give me throughout the year when I ask them for career advice. Every year I pick a few idea slips and then do whatever they say.
It would not be entirely shocking if James Franco did indeed take his career advice from a giant suggestion box. But the truth is, he's either a dabbling dilettante, an artist still searching for his medium, or James Franco is a freak, which seems kind of appropriate. He got his start on TV in 1999, playing a high school freak.
Oh man, you wanna hear something way messed up? You know that Molly Hatchet shirt I was wearing the other day? You know the one with the executioner guy holding that bloody axe?
Writer and director Judd Apatow cast James Franco for the Fox TV series Freaks and Geeks. He says on the set, Franco had a million crazy ideas.
If we were shooting a scene, he would say, I think I'm eating sunflower seeds in this scene. Or in another scene, he wanted to eat a snowball, those giant, disgusting Hostess cakes. So we'd say, James, so every single take you're going to eat an entire snowball? Because we might do this like 20 times. Yeah, I want to eat a snowball. I want to eat a snowball.
Hostess cakes aside, Apatow says Franco was the only actor who asked to shadow the show's director. and who then spent a week watching an episode be cut together. His fellow cast members, however, suspected he might be a bit of a poser.
In between takes, he would read Moby Dick, and no one knew if he was actually reading it or if it was just some sort of showing off.
James Franco went from reading Melville to studying obscure philosophers as an undergrad at UCLA. Professor Ken Reinhart had Franco in 2008 in his senior seminar on political theology.
He wanted to know all about these very, very recent hot theorists, people like Slavoj Žižek and Hélène Bédieu.
After graduating from UCLA with a degree in English, in true Franco fashion, the actor enrolled in 4 master's programs. And this fall, he starts work on a PhD at Yale.
You know, I've always been interested in art, literature, and film and acting. So I guess in the past 4 years, you know, I thought, why not just pursue them all seriously? See how, if they can all come together and how.
Aligning his passion is exactly what his latest project, Howl, does. In the film, Franco's portrait of Allen Ginsberg is a case study of a poet Franco says he's admired since he was a teenager. This is the poet himself.
I'm with you in Rockland, where there are 25,000 mad comrades all together singing the final stanzas of the Internationale.
Franco mirrors Ginsberg so closely. Listen.
I'm with you in Rockland, where there are 25,000 mad comrades all together singing the final stanzas of the Internationale.
Franco's wide-ranging artistic quest for enlightenment has severely confounded his fans. Is he an artist who moonlights as a movie star? Is he a scholar? A poet? Is he just confused? What are we supposed to make of this guy? Again, director Judd Apatow.
Someone who does all of this, it's very easy to look for the crack. What's wrong with him? What is he doing? It's got to be something demented in all of this.
We don't want to know what's going on inside James Franco's head, Apatow says, because what if James Franco is just a nice guy? With more on his mind than a 7-figure paycheck. For NPR News, I'm Jessie Baker.
By the year 2030, 1 billion people on the planet will be over the age of 65. And, for the first time in history, the number of those who are older than 50 will be greater than those under 17. Ted Fishman has traveled around the world to find out the effects this aging trend will have on families and communities, nations and economies. His new book is called Shock of Gray, and he's in the studio of member station WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome to the program.
Glad to join you.
Your subtitle's a little grim, The Aging of the World's Population and How It Pits Young Against Old, Child Against Parent, Worker Against Boss, Company Against Rival, and Nation Against Nation. Is this as apocalyptic as it sounds?
Well, the title's a snapshot of the present because we haven't thought through at the top of our intelligence how to deal with the shock of gray. So that means that there are default solutions, and many of those are coming in the form of what businesses do around an aging population, often reconfiguring the economics of old age, and those effects are sobering.
What do you mean reconfiguring?
Well, you know, we are used to, in the United States and Europe, an old age which is defined by leisure, by retirement. But we are incapable of keeping our promises to ourselves. Either the fortunes of the market have reversed, governments are incapable of stepping up to keep the promises because we just don't have enough money. And so this puts the demand on older people to work longer.
Is this aging trend spread out across the globe or is it confined to developed countries?
It's spread out across the globe. We're just doing it at a different pace. We're comfortably behind Europe and much of East Asia, but the developing world is coming along rapidly. Hmm. Leanne, there's several ways to measure how a country ages. One is, are people living longer? Another is, what is the percentage of people who are older in the population? And if you look at any of those measures, everywhere in the world is getting older, but the biggest numbers are the shifts in the percentage, the proportion of older people that are part of the population, and these are quite dramatic.
You went to Tokyo, Japan, which has more old people than any other city in the world. And you're right that Japan leads the way for other countries because its population is both aging and shrinking. How does that affect society and the relationship between young and old?
Oh, it's quite dramatic. You know, Tokyo is an interesting place because it is so huge. And when you go there, you could see a whole street, throngs of people, all in their 70s and above, or most in their 70s and above, and a service and retail economy that's built around them. and housing that's built around them. And what this is a snapshot of where most of Japan will be heading, because it will be a country where 30% of the population before long will be over 65. You know, I talked before about the reconfiguration of the economic lives of older people. Well, you could see it in Japan, too. So the group that is shopping there, surprisingly, is also a group that's very heavily employed in Japan. Japan has the highest participation of its older workers in the workforce of any country in the world, any developed country in the world. And what happens is that they retire. They don't have enough money to live in expensive Tokyo very frequently, and they need to work. So the day they retire, they're given a gold watch. 2 days later, their employer calls them and says, how would you like to come back to work for half of your pay? We'll give you everything you had before, except we're just paying you half and we're not paying your benefits because your pension and the government will cover your benefits. So you have this vast army of contingent workers, contract workers, who act just like regular full-time factory workers in Japan, for example. They've already been tested as workers. Employers like them. They regard them as family. And a young worker trying to get into the workforce, competing with those older workers, has a very, very hard time.
Developed countries like the United States made major technological advances that prolong life, so the population ages. But there's a downside economically. For example, many state budgets are hobbled by the high costs of pension fund payouts. Are you describing a win-lose situation here?
Well, we certainly win, right? There's nothing better for people than longer life and healthier life. That's what mankind's wanted forever. And if you want any definition of progress, that's a pretty good one. The question is, like all progress, how do we deal with the ramifications of it? So we will have to make choices on where the resources go. If people were postponing some of these decisions to exit the workforce, or if they were made more valuable in the workforce by training, for example, training themselves, going to school, whatever, you can find escape from a lot of these giant obligations that we face.
What effect did the research and writing of this book have on how you think about your own aging?
You know, I really did feel the time tick down as I was writing the book, because you can live to be a vital 90-year-old, or you can be quite hobbled in your late 50s. And it really gave me a lens in which to see everything that was in my view when I walked out my door. I was really looking at people saying, where in the stage of life are they? How dependent are they? How reliant can I be on them? So now I'm just seeing it everywhere.
Ted Fishman. His new book is called Shock of Gray. An excerpt appears in today's New York Times magazine. He spoke to us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now let's hear a tale of two musicians whose paths seem fated to cross, Elton John and Leon Russell. Both grew up at the piano, Elton John in England, Leon Russell in Oklahoma. Both played piano in bars, or pubs in Elton John's case, while still in their teens. Both started as session artists, piano players for hire. But there is one difference. When we sat down together at a rehearsal studio in Burbank, California, Elton John insisted this of Leon Russell.
He is a better piano player than I am. As far as, you know, gospel and stuff like that, that's why I wanted to make this record. He is my idol.
This is from their new album called The Union. It's a collaboration Elton John dreamt up to pay tribute to Leon Russell, an artist he feared might be forgotten.
I've been so many places in my life and time. Sung a lot of songs, I made some bad rhymes.
There was a time when Leon Russell was a sensation. We're hearing him in 1971 at his piano with his long hair and beard and mirrored sunglasses singing one of his classics, A Song for You.
We were alone and I was singing this song.
Leon Russell wrote songs recorded by Ray Charles, Stevie Wonder, Rita Coolidge, Sonic Youth, and as a session player, he was much in demand.
There's something you said a long time ago about playing with
everyone, Joe Cocker and the Rolling Stones and Frank Sinatra, though you said something of Frank Sinatra, that he was one guy that different from everyone else because he had armed guards at the door.
At every door, too, at every door. I wondered if they were expecting a terrorist attack.
I've got two outside, actually. I've got two here now.
Armed guards?
Yes.
Oh, well, let's put it that. But I think Frank Sinatra,
yeah,
he did.
They had gun belts and sticks and all that stuff.
That would have frightened the hell out of me.
As they tell the tale at this rehearsal studio, Elton John and Leon Russell's history stretches back four decades to the night they first met at a legendary club in West Hollywood, the Troubadour. That's where Elton John gave his first ever concerts in the U.S. Then, just 23 years old, with a soulful voice and piano skills to match, those performances were like being shot out of a cannon.
Burn down the mission, Lord, if we're gonna stay alive. Watch the black smoke fly to heaven, see the red flame light the sky.
Singing songs like this one, Burn Down the Mission, Elton John was launched.
I came over to play the Troubadour Club in August 1970. I wasn't sure whether it was the right time to come to America to play, but my record company insisted, and it was the right decision to have made. By hell, was it the right decision? I came on stage with hot pants and, you know, flying boots and with wings on them, and did, you know, handstands on the piano, and there's pictures of me flying horizontally in the air. And then I'm halfway through Burn Down the Mission, and I'm playing the piano solo, and I glanced right, and I see Leon with the silver hair and the Ray-Ban glasses, and I temporarily, you would never know, but I froze. I kind of semi-panicked because this was the man who I really did idolize. I mean, I met him afterwards, and he actually gave me a recipe because I had my throat was beginning to seize up. I think more of excitement than anything else. But he gave me a recipe of one spoonful of cider vinegar, one spoonful of honey in the hottest water you can gargle with. Gargle with it for like a minute, and you'd be surprised what comes out of your throat. And I still, to this day, have that in my dressing room. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
What did you think? This would have been the first time you would have seen Elton John, right?
Well, we were trying to get him for Sheltered Records. Wasn't a lot of white soul singers around at that time. Wasn't any that I can think of, really. And I don't know, I thought it was exciting. I mean, what can I say?
Listen, I was a kid in a candy store. I'm in America. I'm introduced by Neil Diamond. I'm seeing Leon Russell. I'm getting telegrams from George Harrison. I am just delirious with happiness.
Soon after that night, Elton John went on the road as the opening act for Leon Russell. They didn't meet again until Elton John hatched the idea of this collaboration. And they kicked it off listening to an old gospel song by Mahalia Jackson.
Rain 40 days, 40 nights without stopping. The door was clapping, the rain stopped dropping. Knock at the window, knock at the door. Hi, Mother Nora, can't you take home?
I think we were both so shy up to that point, and we were shooting the breeze, we were talking about music, but there has to come a point where you have to get off your backside and go in the studio and actually do something. And that Mahalia Jackson track inspired me to go out. He came out and we had a song.
And the song was?
Yeah, and the song was A Dream Come True.
Now I feel the beat of the dancing drums.
Together this time, after all these years, what was the difference?
I think we're older and wiser. If we were not wiser, then we damn well should be. And I just think it's kismet, it's fate. It's just one of the greatest things that's ever happened to me personally, and definitely musically.
Bless your heart.
We are going to end the piece with the last song on the CD, which is Leon Russell written, Leon Russell sung. Tell me about this song.
Well, I wanted to give him something for doing this for me. I mean, I thought this was a pretty magnificent gift that he was giving me. What do you give a guy that's got 6 fully staffed houses and 10 of everything else in the world? And I thought I could give him a song.
Sorry.
So I was telling my wife, I said, you know, I could give him a song and it could go like this, and that's the one that's on the record. And he liked it. I was very thankful for that.
Well, I could have been sick. I could have died. I could have given up and not tried to make it to tomorrow like a broken hearted lover.
That's Leon Russell singing his song In the Hands of Angels. We sat down with Leon Russell and Elton John at a rehearsal studio in Burbank. They're on tour now for their new album, The Union, a collaboration after nearly four decades apart.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Felix Contreras. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.